You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On May 4th, 1970, four students at Kent State University in Kent, Ohio, were killed and another 13 were injured by members of the National Guard during a protest against the Vietnam War. Sunday was the 33rd anniversary of that incident. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Alan Canfora, a survivor of the massacre, who takes us back to that fateful day in May.
On May 4th, 1970, I was a junior at Kent State University. I was 21 years old. I had been an experienced anti-war activist the previous year. I was a member of the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society at Kent State. And on this particular day, May 4th, 1970, when I was shot, that was only 10 days after I attended the funeral of one of my closest childhood friends. He was 19 years old, killed in Vietnam in the war. And his funeral was April 24th. So when Nixon invaded Cambodia 6 days later on April 30th, 1970, my roommates and I, those of us who had attended that funeral a few days earlier, we joined in the protest very vigorously on May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And of course then on May 4th, the 4 days of confrontation at Kent State ended with the massacre at 12:24 p.m. 67 gunshots were fired, mostly from M1 rifles fired from the hilltop, by about a dozen members of Troop G of the Ohio National Guard. They stood there aiming and pulling their triggers during 13 seconds of gunfire. And I was waving a black flag on that day. I chose black material to symbolize my anger and my despair that I was feeling in those days after my friend's funeral, after he was killed in Vietnam. And I risked my life, I think you could say. I was waving a black flag while some of the triggermen from Troop G were aiming their rifles toward me and others. Several minutes before the shooting, there's a pretty dramatic picture of me on my website, alancanfora.com, showing me waving a black flag while they're aiming. But they didn't fire at that moment when that picture was taken. Instead, they marched back up the hill. It looked like a retreat. And as the 76 guardsmen were marching up the hill, suddenly at the hilltop, out of the 76 guardsmen, only about a dozen from Troop G stopped and turned, and they began to fire. They continued to fire for 13 seconds, killing four students. Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandy Scheuer, and Bill Schroeder were murdered on that day, hundreds of feet away from the killers at the hilltop. I was down near the bottom of the hill, about 225 feet away, and I was carrying a black flag, and I looked up toward the top of the hill. I saw the guardsmen marching away. It looked like a retreat, but suddenly from the hilltop, that's when they stopped and turned and started to shoot. I thought they were firing blanks. But instead, as I ducked behind a tree, which was the only tree in the direct line of fire, I felt a bullet go through my right wrist, and that's when I realized they were firing live ammunition.
Hmm. What thoughts were going through your mind at that point, Alan?
Well, it was a very nightmarish, surreal scene there, Verna. I can assure you, it was a sunny spring afternoon. There was not a cloud in the sky. It was a warm day, and it was our campus. Classes were in. Martial law was not declared until the day after the shootings on May 5th, 1970. So we were just experiencing a normal protest. We didn't expect that at that moment, 12:24 p.m., we didn't think the guardsmen were going to stop and turn and shoot. And when they first started shooting, I think most of us just thought, well, maybe they're shooting blank weapons. There was just no reason to shoot, no rational excuse to fire. But as the gunfire continued and some of us got hit, it was just such a shocking, nightmarish thing. I don't recommend it to anybody, you know, to be shot by a rifle. It was very painful. It was bloody. And I just couldn't believe that they were shooting live ammunition into a crowd of unarmed students.
Hmm. And have investigations been done on that? And why do you suppose that the Troop G, as you say, turned and fired?
Well, you know,
were they given a direct order?
Okay. Yes, it took us quite a long time to really learn the truth about Kent State 1970. Immediately after the shootings, of course, the guardsmen and their commanding officers began a cover-up of murder. At first they said the students shot first. You know, they always blamed the victims. They said the students were snipers, and of course that was later disproven by the FBI and all other investigations. All of the gunfire came from the hilltop, from military weapons. So there was no sniper, but they also said
Did the students even have weapons?
Pardon me?
Did the students even have weapons?
No, the students had no weapons. I admit some students threw a few stones maybe 5 or 10 minutes prior to the shootings, but then there's also photos showing guardsmen throwing stones at us that day. But we were so far apart, the stone throwing was ineffective.
Mm.
And that was really the only violence by the students that day. But every investigation after Kent State, including the FBI investigation, the United States Justice Department's own investigation, and a federal grand jury, a state grand jury, clearly the evidence is conclusive. Even the U.S. Justice Department conclusion was this. The National Guard gunfire at Kent State on May 4, 1970, according to the Justice Department, was unnecessary, unwarranted, and inexcusable. Also, the FBI concluded there was no sniper. They said the guardsmen's lives were not in danger at the time of the shootings. And I think, really, when we heard courtroom testimony years later in 1975, 5 years after the massacre, several triggermen testified in court that they heard a verbal command to fire. And that's the real reason we had the massacre at Kent State.
So I understand that some of those National Guardsmen were actually tried or indicted, but what was the outcome of that?
Yes, among the triggermen, and there were about a dozen members of Troop G, we call them the Death Squad at Kent State. And by the way, these guys, some of them were experienced guardsmen in years before that, several years earlier in 1965 and 66 in Cleveland during the so-called ghetto riots. This same group of National Guardsmen, Troop G, fired gunshots into crowds of African Americans earlier, before Kent State. So these were experienced killers and experienced shooters. And when they got the order to fire, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing, and they followed the orders at
mm-hmm.
Kent State.
Now, 10 days after the Kent State massacre, police killed two African-American students and wounded 30 more at Jackson State University in Mississippi during a protest against the U.S. invasion of Cambodia, as well as of the Kent State killings. Why do you think that in our collective consciousness as a nation, we only remember the incident at Kent State?
Well, I think it's very clear. There was a good bit of racism that existed back at that time, especially in the news media. You know, at Kent State, it was one of the first examples where Caucasian students were shot down and killed. And prior to Kent State and after, it's always been mostly African-American students killed on college campuses, especially from 1968 to 72. During those 4 years, we have documentation of about 16 students that were killed. The vast majority were African-Americans. And in those incidents, I think it was racism. That's the reason why these events were largely covered up. But at Kent State, that was the one incident where the most students were killed, four, and it was the only incident where women students were killed, Allison Krauss and Sandy Scheuer. But after Kent State, 10 days later at Jackson State University in Mississippi, James Earl Green and Philip Gibbs, young African-American students, were killed when about 30 other students were injured. Over 100 shots were fired at Jackson State near a women's dormitory, Alexander Hall. And at Kent State, only 67 shots were fired, but we had more fatalities at Kent. And maybe that helps explain why there was more coverage. But still, at Kent, this year and every year, we remember not only Kent State, but also Jackson State.
What were the lessons learned from Kent State? Could that happen today, particularly in the political climate that we're living in now?
Well, Verna, we have an exact same political climate now, I think. I'm very sad to observe that, again, the American people are divided, pro-war against anti-war, and you have politicians now that are seeking to portray the anti-war protesters during this 2003 war. They're saying the protesters are un-American, unpatriotic, anti-American, treasonous, and this is the same kind of rhetoric and language that the politicians back in 1970 used. Only the day before the Kent State shootings, Ohio Governor Rhodes, a conservative Republican governor, he was pro-war and anti-student, he condemned the Kent State students as worse than the communists, the worst type of people in America, and he pounded his fist on the podium and he said, "We're going to eradicate the problem at Kent State." Well, the next day, four students were eradicated. A few weeks before the Kent State massacre, California Governor Ronald Reagan said, "These students want disruption. If it takes a bloodbath, let's get it over with." President Nixon, a few days before the Kent State massacre, said these student protesters are bums. Well, that's the kind of rhetoric we're seeing again in the year 2003 by Rush Limbaugh, by Fox News, and by other commentators on talk shows across America. They're demonizing protesters once again, And I think this is creating a climate which is very dangerous now, similar to 1970 when we had the Kent State Massacre. And I'm very fearful that, again, we could have students or other protesters shot down, such as we saw in Oakland, California last month, when rubber bullets and wooden pellets were fired into the crowd of unarmed protesters there. Mm-hmm. So it's a very dangerous time, again, for protesters.
In fact, back in 1970, there were many who responded to a rather famous documentary that was produced about that, who said that they actually wished that more of the students had been killed.
Yeah.
These were seemingly average citizens.
Well, you know, that happened back then. I don't think too many people now, though, justify firing 67 shots, mostly from deadly M1 rifles, which are very powerful weapons, which we faced at Kent State. I don't think too many people will justify the murder of unarmed students nowadays. But very sadly, back then, you had some people that supported the governor and the National Guard and President Nixon when the cover-up started at Kent State. I think that happened largely because of the lies and the distortions and the myths. They blamed the victims at Kent State and at Jackson State, just as they always blamed the victims. And so some people were confused about snipers and all these rocks that were supposedly thrown. And the guardsmen claimed the students were about to overrun the troops when, in fact, the closest student at Kent State was 60 feet away. So that's a very sad thing that happened when they covered up murder at Kent State, and it did confuse some people in the immediate aftermath.
You attended the commemoration of the 1970 massacre, as well as an anti-war protest of about 300 people on the campus of your alma mater this weekend. What was that like?
Well, it was very meaningful for me, and not just me, but others who witnessed the Kent State incident in 1970. It's always gratifying to know that every year since 1970, the current students at Kent State organize an annual commemoration program to remember the victims of Kent State and Jackson State 1970. Yesterday was no different. We had very many great speakers, including Jello Biafra, one of the most eloquent, dynamic speakers in America, I think. And also we had Carrie Kennedy Cuomo, the daughter of Robert Kennedy, spoke very passionately about the need to remember Vietnam and Kent State. And we had other student speakers, and also the president of Jackson State University came up from Mississippi, and he was joined by the current president of Kent State, Carol Cartwright. It was a very meaningful day to pause and pay a tribute to our martyrs from Kent State and Jackson State in 1970. But we also talked about the current crisis and the dangers that we face now in 2003, and I think there are many parallels that were brought out yesterday. Now, unfortunately, after our peaceful commemoration event yesterday at Kent State, there was a following demonstration, which was an anti-war demonstration on the campus, and that demonstration led to a march toward the downtown area of Kent, where very many armed local police officers confronted these peaceful protesters, and about a dozen people were arrested yesterday at Kent State.
When you think about student activism then and now, many have dubbed students today in this generation as the sort of the me generation, not really concerned about that much outside of themselves and their own world, outside of their own sphere. Yet we are seeing examples of where students have been protesting, particularly around the war against Iraq. What are your thoughts about student activism as it is developing today in this political climate?
Well, I've studied the phenomenon of student activism in America, and what I've learned is as long as there have been colleges and universities and schools in America, the young people have been active to protest against injustice locally, statewide, or nationally. So the tradition of student activism, I'm very happy to report, is alive and well in America. Some conservatives like Rush Limbaugh and Fox News, they tried to denigrate or push down the importance of modern activism. But I don't think anybody who really understands can deny that the anti-war movement today in 2003 is just as strong or stronger than our anti-war movement in 1970 at Kent State or across America. It's just a myth that some people try to perpetrate by insulting modern activists by minimizing their impact.
Alan Canfora is a survivor of the 1970 Kent State Massacre. He still lives in Ohio, where he's chairman of the Democratic Party in his hometown of Barberton. Along with the other 12 families of the massacre victims, he sued the Ohio National Guard. In 1979, the families were issued a statement of apology and regret, and they reached an out-of-court settlement of $700,000. Most of the money was given to massacre survivor Dean Kaler, whose wounds left him paralyzed from the waist down. As we remember the anniversary of the Kent State Massacre, activism and the exercise of free speech in this country are under threat in the current political climate. The implementation of the yellow, orange, and red alert system has created for some a sense of apprehension over the past few months. And as the powers of the new, quote, Patriot Act, unquote, are applied, every day people are experiencing a loss of civil liberties. More and more citizens have been detained or held incommunicado. A California man's family longs for news of why he was taken and held without the ability to speak with his attorney. In New York City recently, two men were detained in a restaurant by Homeland Security forces. Today, Peace Watch presents this commentary by noted author and journalist Jill Nelson, entitled A Mean-Spirited America.
These days, a sense of apprehension and foreboding lurks in the back of my head and the pit of my stomach. It's a gut-wrenching reminder that something very bad has happened and is about to happen anew. It is an anticipation of the next insult and injury in an America that has been defined under the Bush administration by a profound meanness of spirit. The evidence of this overwhelming meanness of spirit is everywhere. Even the administration's efforts to justify the war in Iraq as one of liberation and declare victory cannot mask the human cost to American troops and their families. How many thousands of Iraqis dead? Where are the ridiculously named weapons of mass destruction that Bush used to justify this invasion? Witness the looting of priceless antiquities, kitsch, and cash from Iraqi museums and Saddam Hussein's palaces and homes, allowed and participated in not only by Iraqis, but members of the American Armed Forces and their embed fellows, the media. Yet to question this war and its aftermath is characterized as at worst treason and at best anti-American cynicism. And woe unto those who criticize Halliburton, Kellogg, Brown, and Root, and the rest of the corporate sponsors of the Bush administration as they line up at the trough of government contracts to rebuild Iraq and control its oil. Now the armed forces in Iraq have turned to shooting Iraqi demonstrators, the very people they supposedly came to liberate with democracy. Here on the home front, our email communications, bookstore purchases, and even our public library withdrawals are open to government surveillance. The Attorney General lengthens the arm of government repression every day, seeking the right to revoke an American citizenship if he alone decides their words or deeds fall within his definition of treason. The Internal Revenue Service announces that it will scrutinize the returns of the poorest taxpayers, those claiming the Earned Income Tax Credit. This is a credit offered to taxpayers who earn under $35,000 for a family of four, and it averages less than $2,000. The Bush administration wants to spend $100 million to go after these working poor Americans in search of fraud, rather than concentrate on corporations who, according to some estimates, defraud the government by tens of billions of dollars every year. This, as President Bush crisscrosses the country like a snake oil salesman in an effort to sell his tax cut program, one that will, again, reward the wealthiest Americans and increase the tax burden on the poor and the middle class. This after already pushing through a tax cut 2 years ago that failed to stimulate the economy, but succeeded in resurrecting a deficit that, at the end of the Clinton administration, a year before, was a surplus. Meanwhile, here in our great democracy, Americans go along with the program or remain silent, too afraid of the Muslim boogeymen thousands of miles away to recognize the Christian ones in our midst, fearful that we will be verbally attacked or shunned or lose our livelihoods if we dare question the meanness that characterizes our government and increasingly defines our national character. I do not feel safer than I did 6 or 12 or 24 months ago. In fact, I feel far more vulnerable and frightened than I ever have in my 50 years on the planet. It is the United States government that I am afraid of. In less than 2 years, the Bush administration has used the attacks of 9/11 to manipulate our fears of terrorism and desire for revenge into a blank check to blatantly pursue imperialist objectives internationally, to begin the rollback of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and most of the advances of the 20th century. It is none too early to begin organizing for the 2004 elections. Each of us must take a hard look at the changes that have been wrought by this administration internationally and domestically and ask ourselves, is this the democracy we cherish? We must hold our elected officials accountable and make them take a stand against what increasingly looks like fascism. If they will not, we must vote them out of office. 3 years ago, before the bloodless coup d'etat that made George W. Bush president, America was a far from perfect nation. Yet there was the possibility, almost gone now, that our country might evolve into a place that lived up to its loftiest democratic rhetoric. Today, I live in an America that makes my stomach hurt and fills me with terror, a nation run by greedy, frightened, violent bullies. It is time to take our country back before it is too late.
Jill Nelson, journalist and author of several books, including her forthcoming novel, Sexual Healing, to be released June 1st. Her works include a memoir, Volunteer Slavery, and the autobiographical work, Straight No Chaser. Jill Nelson presently writes a column for MSNBC.com and the editorial page of USA Today. Last weekend, teachers, students, and non-governmental organizations from around the world convened at George Washington University in the nation's capital for a follow-up to the third UN World Conference Against Racism, which was held in Durban, South Africa in September 2001. This conference addressed issues of racism and white supremacy, as well as the war on Iraq and the Arab region. Speaking to a cheering audience at D.C.'s downtown First Congregational Church, Umberto Brown of the Black Radical Congress and Global Afro-Latino Caribbean Alliance said the oppressive nature of the USA's military foreign policy is well known throughout Latin America.
When you move around the world, people are not confused who is a threat to humanity. The survey around the world tells you, you ask anyone, and 80% say the USA. It's interesting. Educated, uneducated, women, men, black, white, indigenous, people who have been victim of U.S. foreign policy are not confused about it. And Venezuela is very interesting because Venezuela is a reflection of what is happening around the world. Venezuela is a reflection of why we went to Durban. Because Durban is connected to this process. In Venezuela, what you have, and what just happened in Brazil, what is happening in Ecuador and Bolivia, is that the invisible people, the people without voices, have said neoliberalism is dead. They have said we're not privatizing anything else. We're not giving up one more stone with the promise of progress and development. And we went to Durban to say the same. We went there with people for health care, immigrants' rights, refugee rights, housing issue, health issue. So there's something about people understanding these things, knowing about it, talking about it, but why we are not able to influence changes about this. And I think as I live in the U.S., I see there's a different culture, political culture. Because when you come from our region, for example, in Venezuela, people supported Chavez because Chavez spoke for the poor. People supported Chavez because Chavez speaks for the black and the indigenous people. And for the first time, the petroleum of Venezuela has been confiscated for the people of Venezuela versus the 10% of the elite. And that's the problem that we're facing with U.S. imperialism around the world. We in Latin America, we are not confused about who the U.S. is. My country was invaded. Dominican Republic was invaded. The Haitians been killed for more than 100 years. They put Papadoc there. They put Somoza in power. They supported Saddam Hussein, and they created Bin Laden during the Cold War. So that point to me, something that I learned when I came to this country, that history matters. And you have to choose who you believe and what tradition you're going to join. If you join the tradition of winners take all, or you join the coalition of people who have resisted oppression, who continue to organize against oppression, and in many parts of the world, we're starting to defeat our oppressors. And another lesson from another part of the world for this country is that everything in this country has to happen quick. We have not integrated the legacy of our own people against slavery, against segregation. Our people have come a long way and have resisted. We sometimes lose the freedom dream. We lose perspective of what it is we're fighting about. And we become tactician. And I think I want to address some of the problem we're facing for what the brothers say to us. How do we convert it to being a vehicle of change, of transformation in a country that's so dominant by the elite, their ideology, and their media? I also think that we need to question ourselves, that do we really have a vision of what we want? And I'm happy the brother described some of it. Because a movement that is against, but don't have an alternative, don't know where it's going. And I think also, this is a country that I've seen most anti-radical, anti-leftist, anti-revolutionary, anti any idea that is not mainstream. We demonize it by the first doubt that somebody say about that movement is people or mistakes. We drop it. We leave it. We are a crucial moment. And I want to raise an issue that I don't think we understand sometimes. The U.S. have not changed its foreign policy because they're crazy. The United States have a sector in its elite who have decided that the Cold War arrangement is no longer sustainable, that the world has changed, and that the arrangement that exists after the Second World War, both in the U.N., and geopolitically, is not necessarily all they want to control. They feel that they have the right for a larger portion of control of the rest of the world. They feel they have the military capability to impose their will. They also understand that the UN has gone through changes after every major war, and that the UN get constructed according to the forces that win the wars. And that's why they disrespected, they dismiss the UN, because they also want a UN that is shaped around the US strategic and political interests. Because they're all allies, France and Germany, they don't think they need them. When you talk about Latin America and the massacring, because the US is responsible for most of the massacring in our region. They have nothing to tell us about democracy and terrorism. If the American people do not organize to say that you will not support your troops going to kill people in the name of democracy, if you do not intervene to change the way your country is run, where these 100 rich men decide that they're going to bomb and kill people for their economic interests and their allies, you have become complicit in an imperialist society. And you have no option. I leave here tonight asking you to take on the challenge of building a new movement, questioning institutions that don't work politically anymore, and trust that democracy is not built in one day. If slave could have freedom dream and see a future, God knows we must have a vision that these barbaric people cannot run the world.
Humberto Brown is a member of the Black Radical Congress and Global Afro-Latino Caribbean Alliance, speaking at the conference entitled Movement Beyond Borders, After Durban, U.S. Communities Building a Multiracial Justice and Human Rights Vision. Thanks to Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch's producer for Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett, Otto Hammett of KPFA, and T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for their generous financial support over the past several weeks in response to our urgent appeal. Thanks to your support, Peace Watch will continue to be broadcast. But if you'd like to continue to support us, we'd invite you to make your pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.